Okay, good evening, everyone. I want to welcome everyone to our next one of our Ani Mamins. The next one is the 8th, and that is what we're learning together tonight. Tonight's going to be a little bit of a different type of shiur than we usually have. It's okay, it's no problem. A little bit of a different shiur than we usually have. I want to explore a little bit of the Yesod of this emuna, and then I want to take us into a discussion that I don't think we usually have, that has more historical connotations to it, but I think is actually a very fundamental question and something important that we should all know about. So let's begin together. So the Rambam begins in his Perush HaMishnayos, in his explanation of what will become the 8th principle of faith for the Rambam. So if you remember, the last number of shiurim we have been discussing the principle of emuna with relation to Moshe Rabbeinu. How critically important it is to affirm our belief that Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest Navi, that no one greater came before him, no one greater came after him. That no one greater before him, no one greater after him. And as we developed in a number of shiurim, that is so central for us for two reasons. One of which is Moshe Rabbeinu is one of the only human beings to sort of pierce the more spiritual world as a human being and experience a engagement with God as a human being, as a person. That Moshe Rabbeinu was up on top of that mountain living an angelic sort of existence. That Moshe Rabbeinu didn't eat, he didn't drink, and he spoke to God the way we would speak to each other. That's what the pasuk says. And that Moshe Rabbeinu is an individual who perhaps no one could ever replicate his level and his achievement, but nevertheless, he affirms for humanity that such an accomplishment is possible, is within the realm of the human experience, to literally engage the Ribbono Shel Olam. And as the Rambam explained in the beginning of the last one of the Ikarim, that there were some distinguished features of Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevuah. And the most central to those was the notion that Moshe Rabbeinu was fully conscious and alert while he was communicating with the Ribbono Shel Olam. That most Nevi'im went through some sort of trance-like state of consciousness, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed something to them. Moshe Rabbeinu was fully alert, fully in control of his faculties, fully in control of his body. It was really the most extreme example of a convergence between a physical and spiritual experience. And that is critical because even if we're not going to become Moshe Rabbeinu, we still nevertheless strive through tefillah, through avodah, through mitzvos, through Talmud Torah, through kumsitz, through whatever it is, trips to Uman, whatever it is that we are doing to find spirituality, that whole vista is kind of opened by Moshe Rabbeinu. The other element of Moshe Rabbeinu that we discussed, and that's more specific to this this one of the Ani Mamins that we're going to discuss tonight, is the notion that Moshe Rabbeinu is the conduit for the Mesorah. That Moshe Rabbeinu, why do we have to believe that Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest, that no one greater came before him, and even more importantly, that no one greater came after him, that there were no follow-up prophets that clarified or qualified or, you know, to some degree messed with in any way the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu brought down from Sinai. That's obviously critical for us to believe that the Yahadus that we practice today is reflective of the authentic intent of the Ribbono Shel Olam, is an authentic representation of the intent of the Ribbono Shel Olam in what Yahadus should be. So Torah is true, we believe that Torah is true, and this is a belief. We've never met Moshe Rabbeinu, we've never seen Moshe Rabbeinu, we don't have any, although there is a fascinating Tiferes Yisrael that we won't discuss today, that discusses a portrait that was made of Moshe Rabbeinu, a very famous, very strange Tiferes Yisrael. Where actually is one of the source of this whole, with the horns and stuff like that, and there's a whole discussion about somebody who was hired to make a portrait of Moshe. So it's itself maybe something we could discuss another time, but we believe in this. We believe in this. We have a tradition for this. This has been passed on from generation to generation. Now we encounter the animamin that relates to the content of what it is that Moshe Rabbeinu brought down. Because just because we believe that Moshe Rabbeinu is a real individual who actually was on Har Sinai and received the Torah and brought the Torah down, how do we know what is the level of confidence and certitude that we have that the Torah that's sitting in our Aron Kodesh right across the way is indeed the same identical Torah that the Ribbono Shel Olam handed Moshe Rabbeinu. So let's look together. So we're actually going to first read the Perush HaMishnayos. I'm going to skim it, and then we're going to read the actual animamin. So the Rambam says the following. Hayos HaTorah min HaShemayim, to know that Torah is from heaven, v'hu shenamin, and that we believe. Ki kol HaTorah hazos, that all of this Torah, hanesuna yidei Moshe Rabbeinu alav HaShalom, that was given through Moshe Rabbeinu alav HaShalom, she kula mipi HaGvura, it is all from God. Kilomar, as if to say, she higia a love, kula me'es HaShem Yisbarach, that all of it reached Moshe from HaShem, meaning, there was no human intervention, there was no human contribution to the core text of Torah Shebichtav and to the core Mesorah of Torah Sheba'al Peh. Be'inyon shenikra al derech asheola dibur, and it is what we would describe as dibur. Now, the reason the Rambam's a little vague about that is because even the whole concept that God speaks, right, is difficult to say. Speech, as we experience it, as the fluctuation of sound waves absorbed by, you know, these are physical properties. What does it mean that a spiritual entity speaks? So Moshe, Dibur Torah B'loshen B'nei Adam, Moshe experienced this experience as what we would relate to his speech. Then, you know, do a hechikiyah, we don't really understand what exactly that means. Elo hu Moshe alav Hashem sheyigilo, but we know that it reached him. V'chiyu haya kemo sofer shekarim lo, v'hu kosev koma uras ayamim asipurim v'amitzvos, and Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down everything that was in the Torah, v'lefichach nikra mechokek, it's called an engraver, meaning Moshe Rabbeinu took all of this content, all of this information from God, and he carved it into a Torah. V'ein hefrish, then the Rambam says something very important, and there is no difference Bein uvnei cham kush umitzrayim, between the pasuk that expresses the lineage of cham, that his children were named kush and mitzrayim, v'shem ishto mehe tavel, v'timna haisa pilegesh, all very esoteric details of the Torah, right, that probably most of us are not familiar with, right? Some of my kids study Chidona Tanakh, so they're always like, cross-referencing, you know, who are the children of this, and who are the kings of that, and who are the, you know, this and that, and they're always coming up to me like, you went for smicha, you obviously know this, and I'm like, I have no idea, you know, like, unless it's in a pot, you know, like, I'm not going to be able to answer this question, unless they cooked this pilegesh, then I don't, you know, I could tell you if it's no Saint Tom, but, you know, but they're always, so, but, uvein, anochi Hashem Elokecha, ushma Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. There's no difference between the truth and the veracity of the psukim of the Torah that are of the most minute details, and the psukim of the Torah that reflect the fundamentals of our belief. Ki akol mipi agvura. You shouldn't think that God gave Moshe the really important parts, and then Moshe filled this in as a historical document, as a scholar. No. God told Moshe every detail. Akol Taras Hashem Timimah Toru Kedusha Emes. The Rambam was very machpid on this. The Shulchan Aruch talks about, based on the Gemara in Brachos, they used to recite Aseres HaDibros in the context of Tefillah. The Gemara says we don't like doing this because of Taromas Aminim, because it projects the notion that there's something more significant about the Aseres HaDibros than the rest of the Torah. And there is not. The Aseres HaDibros are an encapsulating, comprehensive, categorical overview of the Torah, but the Isurim that are explicated in the Aseres HaDibros are not necessarily of any greater status because they're included in the Aseres HaDibros. And the Rambam was very machped. This is at the root of the Machlokas HaMinhagim. Are we allowed to stand when they read the Aseres HaDibros, right? In some shuls, they clap before the Aseres HaDibros and everybody stands up. The Rambam was against this because he felt that this, if you're already standing anyway, okay, but to clap and stand up. So some shuls have the minhag to clap and stand up. Some shuls have the minhag not to stand up. And some shuls, like our shul, have the minhag to argue about it. And anybody who says that anything here was added by Moshe on his own, that's it. You're a kofir. You're a heretic. Because you think that the Torah has a heart and has a shell. You think there's a core and there are ancillary parts of the Torah. And that's not true. The entire Torah in its totality is of the greatest and most eminent significance as Dvar Hashem. And you think this stuff is from Moshe Rabbeinu, and that's terrible, and you can't think that way. You think Moshe said on his own, and that's not true. And then the Rambam just goes on to develop this further. So turn to the next page, the next source, and that's what the Rambam writes. Ani mamin b'muna shelema. I believe with complete faith. Shekol haTorah, that all of the Torah, hamatsuya ata biyadenu, that is found now in our hands, hi hanesuna leMoshe Rabbeinu olav hashalom. This is the Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu olav hashalom, as it says in Yigdal, Torah emes nosan laamo kel, that the Torah of truth was given to his nation, the nation of God. Al Yad Nivio, through his Navi, Ne'eman Beiso, the faithful one of his household. So it's interesting because if you look at the Animamin, so the Animamin, actually I heard Rabbi Becker make this point, the contrast between the emphasis here. The Animamin emphasizes Animamin Muna Shalema, Shakol HaTorah Metzuyah Atabi Adenu Yisrael Moshe Rabbein Olav HaShalom. The focus of the Animamin is on the notion that the text that we have, the content that we have, is the exact same content as was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. The Yigdal is focused a little bit more on the emphasis on Moshe. That, you know, you shouldn't think, that's a little bit when the Rambam developed this idea, he seemed to focus on that a lot, right? You shouldn't think that Moshe added something. That almost like we weren't given, that this is more of a follow-up to the Animamin previously. Now, you shouldn't think that Moshe Rabbeinu, in his stature as the, you know, quintessential teacher of the Jewish people and the greatest leader, that Moshe Rabbeinu somehow layered into the Torah his own human, ideas. No, Moshe Rabbeinu entirely and purely a conduit of the Ribbono Shalom's ideas. The Animamin sounds like we're more concerned by, like, when you open up the Sefer Torah, you know, this coming week to the Parsha that we're going to read, you know, do we really, really believe that the Parsha we're going to read is the Parsha that Moshe Rabbeinu got on Har Sinai thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago? Is that something that's really believable? If any of you have ever played the game Telephone, right? Where, you know, one person tells another person, and that person tells another person, and then you see at the end how ridiculous it is, how different what was actually came out. I play this every Shabbos with, it's called the Drusha, right? So I give a Drusha, and I say one thing, and everybody goes home and tells their spouse something else. That person then goes to Mincha and shares with somebody, can you believe what Rabbi Glasser said? And they share something else. That person then tells somebody who writes on a blog something else. The person who comments on the blog understands it's something else. Before you know it, you're getting a phone call. How could you? And you don't even know what they're talking about. That has nothing to do with what you said. All this can happen within 24 hours, right? So it's very difficult to transmit anything in such a reliable fashion. And that's a little bit what I want to talk about tonight, which is the transmission of the actual text of our Torah. The actual text of our Torah. It has been drilled into us since we were very young that every letter in that Torah is the letter that Moshe came down from Har Sinai with. And that is that is championed by many as a formulation, and we'll see soon. And there are certain things that are almost dependent on that formulation, some of these Bible code analyses and other things. But as we're going to see, that's not so simple, and we have to understand what this means. So that's what we're going to do tonight. So look at the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Gimel Halacha Ches. So we'll read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down, the last word on the line. Shlosha hein ha-kofrim b'Torah. There are three that are kofrim in the Torah. Ha-omer she'ein ha-Torah me'im Hashem. Somebody says that the Torah is not from Hashem. Afilu pasuk echad. Even one pasuk. Afilu teva achas. Even one word. Right? Even one word is not from Hashem. You're a kofer b'Torah. Im amar Moshe amro mipi atzmo, harizet kofer b'Torah. So certainly if you say that JPS, whatever, you know, one of, you know, some other guy made it up, then you're obviously a kofer b'Torah. But even if you say, no, this is Moshe Rabbeinu editorializing a little bit, that's, you're already together kofer b'Torah. And that's what the Rambam says. So look at the next source in the Pirkei Machshava. So he says, Gam le'inyan kashrus sefer Torah. We know this is true. Where does this come out? Mostly in halacha. Right? Whenever, right, everybody's laning, everybody's happy, and all of a sudden the Baal Kori looks over and he looks a little more, and then the minhag is for a group of people to come up and they look more, and they don't usually know what they're looking for, but they're, you know, on top of things, and eventually they call the rabbi over. He starts looking more, and then this whole thing is solved by an 8-year-old, right? And, you know, trying to figure out in this interesting halachas. But we know that a Torah that has a missing letter, or a Torah that has a puzzle letter, is a puzzle Torah. Why? Because every letter, every word, is essential. Ein kol hevdel in nimchoka aches shel chom, or a yud shel shem Hashem. A Torah is not any less puzzle if you're just missing one letter of the word chom, right? Or if you're missing a yod of Shem Hashem. Now, repairing those two things are very different. One is much more challenging than the other, but HaMechika Poseles Ba'osamida Sefer Torah. Sefer Torah is just as possible. Kol Oz Shebetorah Kol Oz Betochus Kol HaKedushus Kol HaShlemus. Every word, every letter in the Torah has within it all of the Kedusha and all of the Shlemus, the Kol Oz Yishana Mashmo Samukov Nifla. Every single letter, Yeshna, has within it implications of depth and grandeur. Ve'af im ein anu mevinim es adavar. And even if we don't understand the matter, b'chol ofen aleinu lahamin b'davar kiyuma. Even if we think, oh, this looks like an extra letter, this looks like an extra word, that's because of our own human frailty. We don't always understand everything that's in the Torah. But every letter of the Torah has an infinite amount of depth. Since everything said from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, nitnu reshus lachachamim, lidrosh kol os v'kol tag b'Torah. Therefore, every single letter, every single crown in the Torah is open for drasha, is open for interpretation for Torah Shebaal Peh. That's a whole other world. What are the parameters of those types of drushas? That's for another night. Ulahotziman halachos v'dinim mechudashim, to explicate new halachos and new dinim that are not necessarily explicit in the Torah. She'ein makom lidrash is called tevas ha'osos v'atagim lo mikoach ha'amunah she'en kulam min ha'shamayim. Because there's no way that the chachamim would be empowered to interpret all of these aspects of the Torah as representative of what the Ribbono Shalom himself is commanding us to do. If we in fact, and these are talking about drushas, these are not talking about takanas derabanan, these are talking about dine d'oraisa, right? A tefillin, min ha-Torah, mi d'oraisa, have to look a certain way. Those are based on drushas. Shabbos, right? If you go ahead and you do borer on Shabbos, you're chayiv skila. That's an iser d'oraisa. We would put someone to death for that. And if they did it b'mezid b'asra b'edim in the zman of bezdim. There's nowhere in the Torah that it says it's not allowed, you're not allowed to do borer. That's not in the Torah, right? How do you know that? So that's all from limudim of the Chachamim. That's all from Torah Shebaal Peh. So obviously, if the basis, if the foundation of Torah Shebaal Peh is not Dvar Hashem, then you cannot, in good conscience, empower the Chachamim with the ability to legislate and interpret aspects of the Torah as reflective of Dvar Hashem with all of their consequences. Okay, so we understand that every letter is important. So the question that I want to reflect on a little bit tonight is the text itself. Is this assumption that many of us walk around with, which is that every letter in that Torah is exactly the way in which it was given to Moshe at Har Sinai. That every letter in our Torah is the same as every letter in the Agudas Torah, is the same as every letter in the Sephardi Shul's Torah, is the same as every letter in the Yemenite's Torah. All Jews, and there's one thing we all agree on, it's that food is important and all the letters of the Torah are the same, right? So that is what I would like to disrupt a little bit tonight and then talk a little bit about the historical context of that. So first of all, I want to share with you a couple of examples where we already begin to see in our tradition that there were around multiple texts of the Torah. And this appears in a number of different ways. So first of all, let's take a look at an example that all of us will be able to relate to. Okay? So no one get nervous, but source number 6 is from the Haggadah. Okay? The Haggadah says, Chacham Mahu Omer. What does the Chacham say? Ma Eidos V'Achukim V'Mishpatim Sh'Arciva Hashem Elokeinu Eschem. Right? What are these Eidos and these Chukim? What are all these mitzvos that Hashem has commanded you? And the Torah tells us that, the Haggadah tells us, you have to tell them about the Maftir and the Afikomen. Beautiful. That's the Chacham. Then we get to the Rasha. Rasha Mahu Omer. Ma Avodah Azos Lochem. Right? Why do you do this? So the Haggadah says, oh, you see he's a Rasha. Why is he a Rasha? He just asked a question. So the Haggadah answers, Lachem v'lo. He's being exclusionary. He's saying, what is all of this for you? For you and not for him. And therefore, he's the Rasha. What's the obvious question that everyone asks on this piece of the Haggadah? Who else used the word? Who else used second person? The Chacham. The Chacham also said, he said, Eschem. So we have a billion answers to this question, right? We have the answer, well, Lachem and Eschem are different, and we have the Rasha and the Chacham are coming out from different perspectives, and we have the Rasha just said Ma'avodah Zos, and the Chacham said the Eidos and the Chukim, and you see that he really cares about all the different pieces. We have all the different Rushas, all, you know, to try to find him for this question. So if you look at the Yerushalmi's version of this whole thing, says very simple. Tanur Rav Chia Keneged Arba Bonim Divrei Torah Ben Chacham Ben Rasha Ben Tipeish Ben Sheni Yodei Lishol Ben Chacham Mahu Omer. These are all quotes from Sukkot. You understand? So what does the Chacham say? Says the Yerushalmi Ma Ha'edus VaChukim VaMishpatim Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu. What's the next word? Otanu. Okay, that is a quote from a pasuk. That's a quote from a verse. This is what we're quoting Psukim here. So already you see, there are examples of differences in girsos, of differences in texts. Let's look at another one. The Pasuk tells us in Shmos, V'no'arati l'cha sham, V'dibarti itcha, I'll speak to you, me'ala kaporis, from on the kaporis, v'bein shnei akruvim, from the two kruvim, asher ala orona edus, that's on the orona edus, eis kol asher atzaveh elscha el b'nei Yisrael. Right? That which I'm describing to you, I'm commanding to you, B'nai Yisrael. The Ibn Ezra on this Pasuk has a whole discussion of why there is a Vav on the word Ve'ez Kol Asher Atzaveh. That's what this whole Ibn Ezra is about. Pasuk Be'idabra Asher Me'ilav Me'ol Amoid Le'mar Ki O Amoid Shem Kolo Es HaMishkan, that includes the Mishkan, Ve'ez Kol Asher Bo, and everything that's in it, Ve'in Tzorach L'machriya, Ve'tam Vav Ve'ez Kol Asher Atzaveh Kocho. And then he goes on to explain why you need that Vav. There's just one problem. Look at our version of the Mikros Gedolos, and what do you see? There is no Vav. There is no Vav. The Ibn Ezra has a Vav. We don't have a Vav. So we see there are differences. One more example, a very famous example, the Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara is interpreting different phrases. And the Gemara says, Amar Rav Huna Breid Rabbi Yoshua, Ma'aviram Ksiv. Right? The Torah says, Ma'aviram. So, says Tosis, Hashas Shalonu, Cholek Al Sfarim Shalonu. Says Tosis, we have a problem. Our Gemara is Cholek on the text that we have in the Torah. that says Ma'avirim. And there's an extensive discussion in the Gilyon HaShas in on that daf in source number 12 of all sorts of examples of situations where the Gemara quotes Psukim with a different text, with a different formulation than we have in our Tanakh. And in fact, the Rashba in his tshuvas that are miyuchas to the Ramban, the Rashba has a whole tshuva to discuss his approach that when the Gemara makes a drasha off of a formulation that's different from our Torah text, that creates a real crisis, right? Because it's one thing the Gemara is just saying, ah, shenemar, this pasuk. Okay, so it looks like they had a different text than maybe we do, or we, you know, there were some differences that crept in, so, okay. But what if the Gemara darshan something that's different than our text? So the Rashba says, when that happens, you got to fix the Torahs. You got to change the scribes, should adjust the Torah in deference to the quote in the Gemara, because you're going to unravel the whole system. So that was not really accepted by the Sofrim. But you see, there is a struggle, there is a debate, there is a discussion in terms of what this means. So we have to reflect. So what the Rambam said very clearly, that this animamin means that our Torah is the exact same Torah as Moshe Rabbeinu had. So what does that mean in light of all of this? So the Gemara in Kedushin makes a clarifying statement. The Gemara says, if you look at the Gemara in Kedushin, I'm sorry, I just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines from the top. Amar Rabba Bar Bar Chana, Lo Zaz, there are in a whole discussion about different formulations in the Sefer Torah. Lo Zazu Misham, they didn't remove from there. Ad Sheviu Sefer Torah, Uminom, until they brought a Sefer Torah and they counted. Amar Le, Inhu Bikiye Bechaseros V'Yeseros, Anan Lo Bikiyin. Those that came before us were experts in Chaseros V'Yeseros. We are not Bikiyin, we're not experts. What does that mean, we're not experts in Chaseros and Yeseros? Chaseros and Yeseros is when you add an extra yud in something, right? If Yushalayim is made mole, there's another yud. If it's chaser, it doesn't have a yud. Vavs, alifs. Basically, what used to happen is, so let's just take a step back and think about this historically. So Hashem tells Moshe the text of the Torah. And what does Moshe do with that information? So the Medrash says that Moshe wrote 13 Torahs. He wrote one that he put in the Mishkan, and then he wrote one that he gave to all the Shvatim. Each Shevet got a Torah. Now, new Torahs have to be written. We need more texts, right? So the scribes always write the next Torah based on the last Torah. These are human people. There are tens of thousands of words in the Torah. So, I mean, it's not like against the possible, it's not against possibility that they would a mistake would creep in. So that's why there was always one Torah preserved in the Mishkan or the Mikdash, and that was like the master copy. And they would always check Girsos against that copy. What types of things would scribes tend to make a mistake on? Right? What types of things? They're human beings. These are not, we're not in the miraculous world anymore. This Moshe got the Torah, that was miraculous. Now we have normal people that are fallible. Right? What types of changes are likely to creep in with a scribe? So the most likely changes relate to vocalizing the text, right? Sometimes the text is not clear how you should read it. There are no nikudos, right? There are no vowels in the Torah. So how do you explain to people, how do you make clear that that word is vayashov and not vayashov, which have two different meanings? You add above. And that's what would happen, because they would know that they would. So the more vowels creep into the texts, the later the texts. That's the assumption of scholars. The later the version of text. But chaseros, already by the time of the Gemara, anan lo bikin b'chaseros v'yaseros. There were differences that are existing amongst different Sifrei Torah when it comes to chaseros v'yaseros. In fact, the Rambam writes in Hilchas Sefer Torah, and this is the same Rambam that's telling us, right, that it's the exact same Torah. Look at Halacha Dalin. Ulefi Shiraisi. So the Rambam's writing is Hilchas Sefer Torah. Since I saw shibush gadol, I saw many, many mistakes b'chol asfarim in all the Sifrei Torah, shira'isi b'dvarim elu, v'chein ba'alei ha-mesoros, and also the ba'alei ha-mesoros, the people entrusted with perpetuating the tradition. Shekosun u'mechabrin lahodiyu ha-pchusos v'astumos nechlokim b'dvarim elu machlokas asfarim shesom chamaleim. They are trying to decide where to put a pchusa and a stuma that has to do with the spaces that exist in the Sefer Torah. So they're all working off of master texts that have differences. So Ra'isi Lichtov, I decided to write, Hinei kol parshias ha-Torah ha-stumas v'ha-pchusas v'tzuras ha-shuros k'dei letakin aleihem kol asarim la-giyah mehem. So the Rambam then goes on to basically guide in his Mishneh Torah, and I just took a little example of it from you from the very beginning, but he goes through all five books of the Torah and makes clear this is the correct Mesorah. So what's the obvious question? What's the obvious question? So the Rambam's telling you this is the authority. How did the Rambam know the right one? Right? Right there? Everybody's walking around with different texts of the Torah. How did the Rambam know? The Rambam has Ruach HaKodesh and he knows the right text and no one else knows the right text? How did the Rambam know the right text? V'sever shesachamnu ala b'dvarim elu. So what did I rely on? Hu ha-sever ha-yadua b'mitzrayim. It was a text that was in Egypt. Remember, the Rambam ended up in Egypt. Shehu kolel arba ve'esrim svarim, that has all 14 svarim, 24 svarim. Shehaya b'Yerushalayim, that was in Yerushalayim mikama shanim, for a number of years. We're going to discuss this in a second. La'agia mimenu asvarim, in order to make these corrections to other svarim. All of ayu akol somchin, and this is what everybody relies on. Lefi shehigiyahu ben osher. It comes from Ben Asher. That's the name of the person who wrote this master Tanakh. Okay? Ben Asher. So we're going to discuss him soon. And the Rambam relies on this text of Ben Asher. The text of Ben Asher is the Aleppo Codex. We're going to discuss that in a minute. And scholars debate, there is some debate, whether or not the Rambam's exactly referring to the same one, because as we're going to discuss soon, we have substantial components of this text, and there are some differences between, very few, but there are some differences between what the Rambam says you should do and what actually shows up in that text. And so that was developed by a number of scholars to challenge this assertion. Since then, other scholars have found other ways to resolve those contradictions, and if you're interested in that, you could let me know. So turn to the next page. Yes?
So the Dead Sea Scrolls...
Oh, we're going to get to the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay.
Hold on. We're going to get to the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay.
Don't worry.
Okay.
It's excellent that you went there already. Fantastic. First, we're in the Ramah. We're actually going to go back to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dead Sea Scrolls before all of this, right? The Dead Sea Scrolls are way before the Rambam.
Before the Aleppo.
Correct. We're going to get there. Correct. Okay, everyone. Everyone's so excited. We're going to have a class trip to the Shrine of the Book, and we won't tell anyone. We'll just make a special shul. So, all right. So the Ramah writes, look at this halacha, about four lines down. So if you find a psul in the Sefer Torah, you take out a new Sefer Torah, right? Wrong. That you take out a new Sefer Torah, davka shenim tzotos gomor, says the Ramah, that's only if you find an actual mistake. Aval mishum chaseros v'yeseros. But if you just find a mistake that's about a chaser and a yeser, an extra yud, an extra aleph, and it says the Ramah, ein lotzi nacheres. You don't take out another sefer Torah. She'ein sifrei Torah shelanu miduyakim kol kach. Because after all, our sifrei Torah are not perfect. Our sifrei Torah are not perfect. This is the Ramah. This is not some modern day, you know, Makeldick. You know, this is the kind of Ramah that Rabbi Wasserman would show you. You know what I mean? That everybody thinks that if everything passes everything right away. And look at it's a Beferish Ramah that you don't take out a new Sefer Torah. Shenema Sha'acheres Tia Yoser Ksheira. Who said that the one you're taking out is any more kosher than the one you're putting back in? So the one you're putting back in, you're dressing up in the gartel and you're making everybody crazy. You know, and you take it out a new one. The new one you think is any better with the chaseros and yeseros. New one has other things. This one had a yud here, this one had an olive there. Says the Ramah, you don't take them out for that reason. The ein misha yuchol etakna yesh so fine. Okay, so that's a whole discussion. And the Igris Moshe also discusses this lahalacha. He says that even though, he brings up our Rambam, says even though we were so clear that anybody who rejects even a single letter of the Torah is considered a kofer b'Torah, nevertheless, if you're standing in shul and that's the psul, you wouldn't necessarily put back the Torah. Now today, where everybody has so many Sifrei Torah and there are so many, you know, so I guess people are probably more, you know, more inclined to put them back and to take out new ones. But this is the discussion. Okay, so now the question is very simple. So now we understand that it's not so clear. It's not so clear that there's one perfect text. So the question is, our text, the one that we're using, right? Where does it come from? Where does it come from? So we want to believe that it comes from Torah Misinai. Where does it come from? How are we all? Because we're all within general range of the same text. So how? Where is our text coming from? So someone brought up the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Dead Sea Scrolls are very, very important. The Dead Sea Scrolls, just this is just an interesting historical tidbit. And some of what I'm going to share from you now comes from Dr. Hidri. I heard this from him. Just an interesting... November 29th, 1947 is a very important day in the history of all of this because a number of things happened on that day. What happened on that day? What's the first thing that happened on that day? That was the day of the UN partition vote, right? That was the day of the UN partition vote. That's number one. Number two, that was the day that the State of Israel took possession of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dead Sea Scrolls, what are they? So they are a group of scrolls that were found by accident by a Bedouin Arab who happened to be hiking in the Judean hills and threw some rocks in a cave, was kicking stuff around, and something hit a jar. Walks in to explore, walks up to these jars, opens up these jars, recognizes that there are scrolls, brings them to the market to try to sell them, saw that they might be valuable. Somebody knows somebody knows somebody. They make their way to scholars, and a number of scholars go in to try to get control of these scrolls. Now, they didn't find all of the Dead Sea Scrolls at once. They found a number of scrolls at the beginning, and they went back to excavate more caves so they could find, and they found many more scrolls. If you've ever been to that area, what's called Qumran, you know, and they found much more stuff. There is a lot of debate in the world of scholarship as to who it was that exactly wrote these scrolls. Were these Jews fleeing Roman persecution? Were these some subsect of Jews called the Essenes? Were these early Christians some people like to believe? And there are a number of different, there are fascinating books that you could read that talk all about this. Why the Dead Sea Scrolls so important? The Dead Sea Scrolls are so important because they are the oldest living text of the Bible that exists in the world that we have. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are thousands of fragments. In other words, not just like a long scroll. They believe they were put there by Jews who their intent was somewhat to preserve them. They remain undisturbed for close to 2,000 years. You're talking about very old, old texts. And it took a tremendous amount to unroll them without breaking them and to analyze them and photograph them. They're all online now if you wanted to go and analyze it yourself. And those texts have representation from all 24 books of Tanakh except for one. There's only one book of Tanakh that does not show up anywhere in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You want to guess which one it is?
Daniel?
No. Esther. Esther is the only one. Okay? And there's a lot of discussion why that is. It could just be bad luck. It could just be that, you know. And the text that there is the most of is we have the most of Tehillim. And there are fascinating things that are going on in these texts. So again, when you open up the Dead Sea Scrolls and you see virtually, not down to the letter, but virtually an identical text to your Tanakh that was printed last year, and you look at the two and you realize that, over the course of 2,000 years, with all the scribes and all the travails of Jewish history and all the pogroms and holocausts and crusades that happened in between these two, the fact that we have retained these texts to the degree that we have is unbelievable. So look at the next page, and I'll give you a great example.
The Dead Sea Scrolls are just Sifrei Tanakh?
No. There's much more than just Sifrei Tanakh. There's all sorts of Kachim type things, like things related to the Beis HaMikdash. There are Midrashic-esque type texts. There are, I think, parts of the Apocrypha that show up in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's the Temple Scroll. There are many different types of scrolls. So let me just show you one interesting thing, since we're on this subject, okay? So in source number 19, you have here a picture of what's called the Psalm Scroll, okay? That's from Sefer Tehillim. So this is the piece of Ashrei. So look at the end of the first line of the second picture, okay? And you could probably make it out. U'memshalticha b'chol dor v'dor, right? You see that? U'memshalticha b'chol dor v'dor. Then in the Dead Sea Scrolls, Psalm Scroll, after every pasuk of Ashrei, it says Baruch Shem Kvod Le'olam Vo'ed. Then look at the next where the other dot is. What does that say? You were correct, Dr. Singer. What did you say?
There's a nun.
There's a nun verse. We do not have a nun verse in Ashrei. In fact, not only do we not have a nun verse in Ashrei, but the Gemara in Brachos on source number 18 says, Rabbi Yochanan, mipnei ma lo nemar nun b'ashrei. And he gives an answer. Mipnei sheyesh ba ma'palos and shoshoni Yisrael. Because what would the pasuk have been? Naflo lo sasif kum betzulas Yisrael. And that's not something you want to include in Ashrei. That's always a very troubling Gemara, because that proposed pasuk for the nun verse of Ashrei sounds nothing like the rest of Ashrei. The pasuk included in the Dead Sea Scrolls is Neman Elokim Bidvarov V'chasin B'chol Ma'asov. So the question is, and they discuss this, what exactly was the scribe doing here? Is this another version of Tehillim, a long lost version? First, the scholars thought.
Art scroll print, and they were protecting.
First, the scholars thought that really there was a nun verse, and just we lost it, and now we found it, and we should put it in all the Siddurim, and we should, you know, and this is the nun verse. So that died down because it's a very suspicious verse, because the last half of it, V'chasid b'chol ma'asav, is part of another verse, right?
Yeah.
So that doesn't happen in Ashrei. So the assumed narrative of what happened here is that the scribe writing felt it makes sense not to have it. So he put in an inverse. He added an inverse. And this is what happens to texts. This is what happens to. So that's the Dead Sea Scrolls. So what happens? Yeah.
Excuse me, but there are versions of Gemara that can have missing.
Mm-hmm. There are
sugyas,
right?
Because there was at a certain time when they were reprinted, there was fear from the ruling
Correct.
In Russia.
Correct.
So they took certain things out the same way that the pasuk in Elena was removed.
Correct.
And really, very recently.
Put back. Correct. And those Gemaras, you can buy versions of the Gemara that
I own some of those that were my great-grandfather.
Right.
So.
That put all those back. Yeah. A lot of those, there's censorship all over the Gemara. But that's itself an interesting discussion. So where is our Tanakh from? So our Tanakh mostly comes from a document with a fascinating history called the Keser Arom Tzova, which is what is otherwise known as the Aleppo Codex. The Aleppo Codex is the oldest living Tanakh, the oldest Tanakh that we have. Again, the Dead Sea Scrolls have pieces of Tanakh. There isn't a full Tanakh. If you've been to the Shrine of the Book, which is really one of the most inspiring experiences in the world, but if you've been to the Shrine of the Book and you've been inside it, the whole circular thing, so there are very large portions of Yirmiyahu on display and other pieces, right? But it's not all there. The most complete one we have is called the Aleppo Codex. The Aleppo Codex was written in around the year 930. Okay? So we're assuming that the scribes got us from the times of Tanakh all the way to 930. 930. That's about 1,000 years. Okay. From at 930 was written. It was written by a family, the Ben Asher family in Tveria. And it has, you can't see it so well here. It basically has two columns. And its real amazing feature is what we call the Masoretic notes, the Masorah Katana, the Masorah Gedola. All over the Aleppo Codex, which you could see is written very beautifully, all over the Aleppo Codex is little notes that correspond, little letters that correspond to notes. What do the notes tell you? The notes tell you this word in the Tanakh is spelled the same way in these three other locations. Then it gives you the psukim where you could find those other locations. By doing this, they had essentially encoded within the Tanakh, right, an index. Right. And even though we don't, as we're going to see soon, we don't have the whole Aleppo Codex anymore, Dr. Breuer was able to almost recreate a lot of it through that. So the Masorah Katana and the Masorah Gedola. In around 1030, around the year 1030, it was purchased by who in Yerushalayim? Who do you think is very, very interested in Jewish history in the 11th century, is very interested in a perfect text of Torah Shebichtav?
Christians.
Not Christians.
Muslims?
Karaites.
Oh, of course.
Karaites, who only follow Torah Shebichtav, are interested in a perfect verse. So they buy this Aleppo Codex. And in fact, in the original, there is even there's a few lines that describe this purchase. We have letters about the purchase, and it goes to Yerushalayim. In the year 1099, the Crusades reach Jerusalem, and they pillage Jerusalem, and they take the Codex, and they bring it to Egypt. And it lives in Egypt for a while, and that is where we believe it was used by the Rambam. And that's where the Rambam came into contact with it, and it is used by the Rambam. In around the year 1375, it is taken by, it's unclear exactly who, but it is taken from Egypt to Aleppo, Syria, right? The same town that's in the news, that everybody is, focused on in the news. There was a huge Jewish community there, a very devoted Jewish community there, and they are and they're sitting there with this Tanakh. For 600 years, the community of Aleppo guards the Aleppo Codex. That's where it gets its name, and guards the Ketam Aram Tzova. It sits in a safe, in an iron safe, in what's called the Eliyahu Hanavi room, in the back of their shul. Right, it gives new perspective to the Seamus, in the shul, right? In the back of their shul. And they see themselves as the guardians of the Aleppo Codex. They bring it out once a year. When would you bring it out once a year? Maftar Yonah, right? They bring it out to read Yonah on Yom Kippur. And it becomes a place of tefillah. People come and daven near it. People come in and take shavuos near it. And the Aleppo Codex is consulted constantly by Rabbanim, and we have letters. For example, in the Sfarim of Rav Eliyahu ben Chaim in Turkey, we have when people, he corrects Sofrim in what to write by asking the Rabbanim in Aleppo to check the Codex. So we have many letters going back and forth, and basically for 600 years, the Rabbanim of Aleppo, they kept, vigilance on this Tanakh, and this is what everybody was using to check all of the different scribes. And this is what, for close to 1,000 years, kept us literally all on the same page. So then what happens is, and the whole thing is there. The whole Tanakh is there, all 24 books, right? That 1,000 years old. November 29th, 1947, the UN says there's going to be a state of Israel. What do the Arabs do?
Kick out the Jews.
The Arabs riot. Where do they go in Syria? To Aleppo. Where do they go in Aleppo? To the shul. What do they do to the shul? They burn down the shul. They burn down the shul. They find the codex. They trash the codex. And here, it becomes complicated exactly what happened. Now, before 1947, there were scholars from Israel that traveled to Syria at great risk of their life to try to get pictures of the codex, but there wasn't a lot of film to try to see, to try to check things. But already the Syrian community had become very guarded about it, and they were very suspicious because they knew that one of the things that the early Zionist scholars wanted to do was get this codex to Israel, because all of this, and today, this resonates so much with us tonight. You know, all of this, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Aleppo Codex, all of this was about substantiating our relationship to the land as predating all the people who lived there, right? So this was very, very important to the early Zionist. And in fact, Ben Tzvi, who became the second president of Israel, he was the primary scholar that ultimately... So in 1947, they trashed the shul. And then in 1958, the rabbis in Aleppo smuggled the codex, what's left of it. So the shul was burned. And the story that came out of Syria was the codex is gone. So the codex was not completely gone. And the rabbis in Aleppo went ahead and they wrapped the codex in all sorts of different things and in a rug. And they put it on a Jew who was getting expelled from Syria and they smuggled it out of Israel. There is a massive controversy regarding who they intended that codex to reach. The descendants of the Aleppo people believe and have documentation that they intended it to reach the Rabbanim of the Aleppo community that had made their way to Israel, because the Mossad was rescuing Jews, getting them out of Syria already then. When it reached Israel, it made its way to the Ben Tzvi Institute, and it was taken control of by the government, and they had it. All we know is when they get it, it's no longer complete. It now only has, I think I wrote it down somewhere, it now only has 294 of the 487 original pages. What's missing? Pretty much all of Chumash, except for the last few pieces of Devarim. So the people from Aleppo said it was burnt. It was burned. The Aleppo Codex was burned. This is what we were able to rescue. The Shamus went into the shul. He was able to rescue some of it, but not all of it. The rest of it is gone. That became very suspicious because scholars could not find evidence of burn on the rest of the codex. So they were very skeptical about that. And so it's missing. And over the last 25 or 30 years, one or two pages have appeared. There was somebody in Brooklyn whose aunt was from Aleppo and gave her a page and she returned it to Israel. And then there was a man in Brooklyn who also grew up in Aleppo and was walking around with a fragment of the Aleppo Codex in his wallet for good luck. That fragment is of the part of the Aleppo Codex that has the makos of Tzfardea and Kinim. So that's also now already been returned to Israel. But there's tremendous suspicion that there was no fire, that these couple hundred pages are absolutely out there, that they're very hot, because you can imagine like what the implications are, and that somebody's walking around with them, somebody has them, and this is one of those mysteries that there have been books, there have been documentaries. There were also curses placed on the codex, and it says it on the top of the pages. You're not allowed to sell it, you're not allowed to pawn it, you're not allowed to give it to anybody. That's one of the reasons why the Aleppo rabbis didn't want to give it over. The professor got the Rabbanut HaRashit of Israel to declare the klolos no longer applying before he brought them to Israel. There's a whole side story with Edmund Safra that was reported in the New York Times, a very wealthy Jew from Venezuela, I think, whose family supposedly was involved, and he wrote a blank check to try to find the rest of it. We don't have the rest of it. We don't know exactly where it is. But today, when you go to the Shrine of the Book, I was there a few years ago, not only can you see the Dead Sea Scrolls, but sitting there in the front is the Aleppo Codex, is the oldest representation of Tanakh. And it's just an amazing thing to be able to stand in a room, and when we did this with some of the students that we took, we had them bring their own Tanakh. And we showed them, here you have Yirmiyahu and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here you have it 1,000 years later, virtually the same text in the Aleppo Codex. And here you have it in your hand 1,000 years later, holding on to it yourself. So does the Rambam mean that every single last letter is exactly the same letter? No. Does the Rambam mean that we have a tremendous loyalty to the belief that the substance and content and details of Torah have managed to survive all of the vicissitudes of Jewish history on so many different levels, on so many different, you know, challenges and so many different difficulties? And that speaks to the divine, the hashkacha, the hashkachas Hashem, in terms of, and the Jewish people's commitment to text as something that's so core to who we are. You know, that's very much part of what this Ani Mamin's about. And next week we'll just wrap it up with some other reflections. But I think that this gives us some perspective about, you know, who we are and where we come from, and the whole convergence of the scrolls and the codex and the establishment of the State of Israel in and of itself, I think, speaks to sort of the divine whisper that this is, you know, this, we're in a different era. We're in an era where we're connecting a past to a future. And that's something that we have to take very, very seriously, and we should be very inspired by. And that concludes tonight. Okay.